Well, as you know, we've been going through questions and answers over the last several weeks, and next week will be our last Q&A session. And so I think I know what I'm going to talk about next week, but I'm still debating, so we'll just have to wait and see. But I've received a number of questions that have to do with Bible prophecy, end-time events, the rapture and the feast, the trumpets, judgments, the bold judgments, and the trumpet judgments, and Antichrist, and all this sort of thing. Many of them just in conversations. Some of them are written and sent in. So I'm not going to read all the questions. They just go all the way across the spectrum. And for a long time, people have been asking me about end-time events. I've shared with you, I used to be an expert on end-time events, you know. I used to know everything there was to know about them. And if you disagreed with me, you were just wrong. I mean, that's all there was to it. You were just wrong. And I taught in our church. I taught several churches, long seminars, so to speak, on end-time events. I even taught the adult education at the local high school in the evening education a few times. And a lot of people paid money to come hear me expound upon end-time events. But for about the last 10 years or so, I haven't taught on end-time events at all. And the older I get and the more I learn, the more I realize how little I know. And I realize how... Oh, what's the word? How much hubris. There's your word for the day. How much hubris I had thinking I understood end times and trying to put my interpretation and my spin on what I thought the Bible was clearly saying. But as I've studied more, I begin to realize that I'm just not so sure I had the right take on things. Now, I want to share a passage with you. It's one I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's from Revelation. Revelation chapter 19. By the way, they've been working on the screen. It's stuck. And so as long as this screen is stuck down, they can't put it up. I can't use the big screen back here. So if the overhead does not show up, if it goes off the bottom of the screen, just point up this way, and I'll know I need to adjust things up here so you can see. Revelation, you're going through Revelation. John is seeing all these amazing things, describing them in first century language. What he sees, he describes best he can. And finally, he gets almost to the end of this revelation. And he sees these glorious events. And then this angel, this messenger, we don't know if it's an angelic being or if it's a one of the prophets who had already died and gone into glory, who's escorting John through the vision. We don't know. But anyways, John finally reaches the point where he was just so full of the glory of God and the spectacle of what God's doing in human history. He says, I fell down at his feet, not God's feet, the messenger's feet. I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, you must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold to the testimony of Jesus or Yeshua. Worship God, for the testimony of Yeshua is the spirit of prophecy. Now, for a long time, I didn't quite understand that last bit. The testimony of Yeshua is the spirit of prophecy. And I would look at end-time events and study things like the rapture and the tribulation, the Antichrist. I'm thinking, how is the testimony of Yeshua the spirit of that? And then it finally hit me that prophecy only has a little bit to do with end-time events. In fact, when you talk about Bible prophecy, you're talking about every word in the Bible. Because prophecy does not have to do with end-time events so much as just speaking forth God's truth. The Jews have known this, and in Hebrew it's perfectly clear. Moses was called the greatest of the prophets. Yet of the five books that God gave us through him, the Torah, only a very small fraction has to do with what we call prophetic events or foretelling the future or end time events. Very little. Every word that Moses spoke, every word that he wrote is prophecy. But only a very small fraction of that has to do with future events. You follow what I'm saying? When you realize that God speaking through his people, that is what prophecy is, then you realize that all prophecy, the spirit of all prophecy, the spirit of all of God speaking through people from the beginning of time is the testimony of Yeshua. It is all about him. And what happens when we look at end time events and pull those out and say, we're going to look at these things by themselves, somehow Yeshua kind of gets left by the wayside. It's not about him anymore. It's about us and what's going to happen to us, you see. Now, these end time things that are somewhere in the future are called the birth pains. When Adam and Eve sinned, the penalty that God put upon Eve and upon womankind was this: in pain you'll bring forth your children. Why? What does that work? I mean, why that punishment? It's because at that moment God was proclaiming and was telling us that this world is going to grow old and die, and it will be replaced with a new one. A new world to come is going to come and replace this one. But it's going to come through tremendous pain. Tremendous pain. And so Eve, for you to bring a new life into this world, you will go through pain. And every time you go through those labor pains, you're picturing the labor pains the whole world's going to go through to bring in a new world. Because remember, every soul is an entire world on a small scale. So every time a woman goes through labor pains in the process of bringing a new life into the world, that's a small picture of the great labor pains of the universe bringing forth the world to come. And just as labor pains get more severe and they become more frequent as you get near to the birth, the same thing will happen in human history. And I bring this up because, you know, we have three expectant mothers here at Beth Tikkun that we're aware of so far. And when I hear them talk, you know, we'll chit-chat, and I'll hear them talking with Robin or other ladies, what they talk about is the baby that's coming. The excitement over the baby is coming. That is what is overwhelmingly in their conversation. But picture an expectant mother, and all she talks about, oh, I'm afraid of the labor pains. Yeah, but aren't you excited about the baby? I'm just afraid of the labor pains. And yet, that describes most believers. We're not that thrilled about the world to come. All we're doing is dreading the labor pains before the world to come. And that is not the sign of a people of faith and of hope, but of truth and people of joy. That is not the way we're supposed to be. But I'm going to get back to this about prophecy being God speaking forth truth. It's depicted in a really neat way in the Hebrew. Most of you are aware of this. The Hebrew word for father is Aleph Beit. The first two letters of the alphabet spells Av. Av means father. Beit and Nun spell the word Ben, which means son. And that is the second word you see there. Now, those of you who are Hebrew students, you know I formed the Nun in its normal shape instead of its final form. Nun changes shape at the end of a word, but I didn't change the shape in this case. I just left it in its normal form. But there's a reason for that. You'll see in a moment. Now, if you take Aleph Beit and Beit Nun and put them together, you get Aleph Beit Nun, which spells Evan, which means rock. And when the prophet talks about the stumbling stone, the rock, the Evan of offense, that's the word that is used. And you'll notice that word, the first two letters spell father, the second and third letters spell Ben, son. And the rock of offense for the Jewish people and for many Gentiles as well is that the Father and Yeshua, his Son, are one. It's amazing. I talk to Jewish people, and I've often talked about Hebraic logic, Hebraic thought, that can hold two opposing ideas that are both true, but when they conflict, they can still hold them in that tension. That's an amazing thing. Greek thought doesn't let us do that very well. It makes us very uncomfortable. Like predestination, the Bible clearly teaches that. Free will, the Bible clearly teaches that. But in Greek logic, one has to go. You can't have them both. Hebraic logic, what's the problem? They're both true. I don't have to understand how they fit. But when I talk to Jewish people, when it comes to Yeshua being the Word made flesh, to Yeshua being the Son of God, they can't put those two things together. They're offended by that, and they stumble over that. So anyways, reason I'm showing you this is for this reason. Evan is rock. It's made up of father and son. This is the Evan. This is the rock that people stumble over. But now if we take the word Evan and we reverse it, and this is something that's amazing about the Hebrew language. There are many names and many words that you see one thing, and then when you reverse the spelling, it reveals another level. When we reverse it, we get the word Nava, which means prophesy. Because what is the spirit of prophecy? The testimony of the Evan, the testimony of Yeshua, the testimony of the rock. You understand? So the very word that means to prophesy, the three-letter root, Nava, is Evan, spelled backwards. Now, if you put a yud in there, stick and make it Navi, that means prophet. Okay? Prophet. A Navi is a prophet. This is why the middle part of the Tanakh is called Nevi'im, the prophets. And we sing the song Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet. But going back to that word Nava, prophesy, that's a homophone for another three-letter Hebrew root. That's spelled the same way, except the last letter changes to an ayin, and it's also pronounced Nava. It means to gush forth, to flow forth. And that three-letter root is found in a three-letter form only one place in Scripture, and that is in Proverbs 18:4. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters, and the fountain of wisdom is a, and there's the word Nava, a gushing brook. One of the greatest Hebrew scholars of the past century was Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. He even made his own dictionary of biblical Hebrew. He was quite a writer. He's a brilliant man. And he says, a Navi, a prophet, then, is a wellspring of living waters for God's Word and Holy Spirit, a channel through which God's Spirit speaks to mankind. A Navi, a prophet, is not one who just foretells, but is essentially God's channel. So, the reason I'm going over this is because from now on, when we talk about prophecy, don't think just end-time events, even though there are thousands of books out there now that are about Bible prophecy, and they're exclusively about end-time events. They're misnamed. Prophecy has to do with all the truth God would communicate to mankind. And this is why he does it through Yeshua, who is the Alpha, the Omega, the Aleph, the Tav, the first and the last. He's the alphabet. He is the very communication of God to the world. And the testimony of him is the spirit of prophecy, of God's flowing forth his truth to the world. Okay, are we together on that? You understand what prophecy is? It's not just end time events. It's God speaking forth his truth. Now, the Bible's full of foretelling. Let me put it this way. The Bible tells us a whole lot about the end times, but our ability to understand it is very limited, unfortunately. And when we look at the prophecies about Messiah, it's amazing as we go through. You see the pictures and the types and the prophecies about Yeshua, and then we see how they were fulfilled historically. It's just incredible. But one of the things I've never heard anybody do a study on until this morning, I'm sure somebody has, I've just never heard one, and so I'm going to assume you haven't either, is a study on what a terrible track record those first century scholars have when it comes to understand the prophecies that were right there in their Bibles. What I want us to look at is a few of the prophecies about Yeshua, how they're fulfilled, but how the people right there in his time and day got it so wrong. They got some things right, but they were so wrong on so much. So I've been reading through John. We could go to a lot of places to study this, but let's go to the Gospel of John. I really enjoyed reading the new Delitzsch Gospels. The First Fruits is just printed, and I jumped right to John because it's a book I just keep reading through on a continuous cycle anymore. And so I just jumped into the beginning. And so we're going to look at John chapter 1. And we'll start with verse 19. John 1, 19. Okay. This is the testimony of John when the Jews or the Judeans sent to him priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you? Who are you?" I mean, this is a unique character. And they thought, all right, is he the fulfillment of some prophetic things from the Torah, the prophets, the writings? Is he a fulfillment? Is he one of these forerunners? They were expecting a Messiah right about that time because Daniel made it pretty clear that right there in that generation, the Messiah would have to come. So, who are you, John? Well, right away, he says, "I'm not the Messiah." He confessed to them, verse 20, and did not deny, but confessed, "I am not the Messiah." So if that's who you think I am, you're wrong. That's not who I am. Now, why were the Jews expecting a Messiah? There are many prophecies, but let's just take one specific one from Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Isaiah, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse." Picture a tree. It's cut down. All you've got is a stump now. Then out of that stump grows a little sprig, a little branch, the promise of a new tree. That's the shoot that comes out of the stump of Jesse. Now, who's Jesse? David's father. "And a branch from his roots shall bear fruit." So the shoot matures, it grows, it produces fruit. Fruit has seed. It's something that's going to reproduce and grow and have a future. "And the spirit of Adonai shall rest upon him." So now we know this shoot is a person. "And the spirit of Adonai shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of Adonai. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eye sees, or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked one." I love that part. You know, horror movies are produced by Hollywood about the Antichrist. He's like this character. I don't watch these movies, but I mean, it's like he's always portrayed as some kind of a character who's just unbeatable. But the prophet says that this is the way God does away with the Antichrist. He's gone. That's it. He's not much. He's all show, no go, really. "Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf, and the lion, and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of Adonai as the waters cover the sea." Let me make one little comment about that last. It says, "The knowledge of Adonai will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea." Now, the scriptures tell us that right now the whole earth is full of God's glory. Think about this for a moment. Right now, at this moment, the whole earth is filled with His glory. It's just that we're blind to it. Some are very, very blind to it. But hopefully, as we grow in the Lord and grow in knowledge of His Word, we begin to see the glimpses of His glory shining through the creation, shining through the people we meet. But the earth is full of His glory right now, though our eyes tend to have scales over them. But someday, not only will the earth be full of His glory, but filled with the knowledge of God, to where everyone will know Him. And in Jeremiah 31, it talks about the new covenant. I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel, house of Judah. I'll write my Torah on their hearts. No man will tell his neighbor, "Know the Lord, for they'll all know me, from the least to the greatest." Won't it be great when the knowledge and the awareness of God fills the earth just as much as His glory does? That's going to be something. His glory is here now. We just don't see it very well because we don't have all the knowledge we need and the wisdom and insight we need. But anyways, here's one wonderful graphic prophecy of the Messiah. And no wonder the Jewish people were so looking forward to the Messiah coming, because there's going to be peace. There's going to be knowledge of God. And there, you know, even the animal kingdom will be at peace with itself. But John told them straight up, "I'm not the Messiah." Didn't even wait for them to ask, "I'm not the Messiah." So then they go on and said, well, In verse 21, they asked him, "What then, are you Elijah?" And he said, "I am not." Now, why would they think it would be Elijah? Why were they expecting Elijah? Well, in Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6, it says, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of Adonai comes. And he will turn the hearts of fathers to the children and the hearts of children to the fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction." So, before the great terrible day of the Lord, Elijah has to come. His job, to turn the hearts of the fathers to children, and children to the fathers. This does not just mean restoring family relationships between fathers and children. The fathers in Hebrew, ha-avot, is always, even when used by Paul in Romans and other places, ha-avot refers to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And you can include Joseph there as well. It refers to the patriarchs. And so the purpose of Elijah coming is to turn the hearts of the children, that would be us, back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is one of the reasons Beth Tikkun exists and why Messianic congregations around the world are growing and flourishing every day. There are new ones coming into existence. This is why so many Christians are now going back, says, "I want to understand the Old Testament." And then they find out the Old Testament is still as fresh and new as the day God spoke it to us and it was written down. And it is our scriptures. They apply to us. And God has turned the hearts of the children back to the fathers. He's taken the hearts of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the people whose hearts were filled with Torah, and He's put it into us as the children. What we see happening now is a fulfillment of prophecy. Your being here today is a fulfillment of prophecy. This is an exciting thing to be a part of. So anyways, are you Elijah? Nope, not Elijah. Well, they had a third possibility. He said, "Are you the prophet?" And he says, "Are you the prophet?" He answered, "No." Now, who is the prophet? Well, in Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 19, Moses prophesied, and he said, "Adonai your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers." You got it? Adonai someday will raise up a prophet like me, like Moses. Now, this is important. We know that this prophet is Yeshua, right? Did you ever think that Yeshua is like Moses? And if you study Moses, you'll learn more about Yeshua? Did you ever think to do that? But anyways, when we start our Torah cycle, we'll look into that more. "It is to him you must listen." In other words, you didn't listen to me too well. You must listen to him. just as you desired of Adonai your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly when you said, let me not hear again the voice of Adonai my God or see this great fire anymore, lest I die. And Adonai said to me, they are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him, and whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. So, these messengers come to John the Baptist, and he says, I'm not the Messiah. Well, are you Elijah? No. Well, are you the prophet that we're expecting? And he said, no. That exhausted their list. They had three possibilities. They hoped John was fulfilling one of them. He says, nope, none of those. Now, they had the entire Hebrew Scriptures. They had everything was written there. They've been studying it for years, for centuries. They'd been studying their entire lives, and they'd come up with three prophetic personalities they were looking for: Messiah, Elijah, and this mysterious prophet. They go to John, he says, nope, none of the three. So they said to him, who are you? So that we may give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself? John gives them a fourth possibility that they had never considered. Now, let's learn a lesson from this. You take all the things that are written about the end times, that all the commentators and pastors and teachers are saying, this is the way it's going to look. I guarantee you there's 25% that they're overlooking. I guarantee. At least 25% of the things that are in our future, they don't even see. I don't think their track record is going to be any better than the track record of these men who were there at the top of their game in the first century. So he quotes Isaiah 40. And here in Isaiah 40, verses 1 to 5, it says, comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem, and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from Adonai's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way of Adonai. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. And the uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of Adonai shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. For the mouth of Adonai has spoken. Why weren't they looking for this voice in the wilderness? Because you can't see a voice. They were aware of this prophecy. It just says, a voice cries in the wilderness. They never expected it to be in the form of a man. They never expected this voice to take the form of a human. But John the Baptist says, here's who I am. John knew who he was. And he says, I am the voice crying in the wilderness. Make straight the way of Adonai, as Isaiah the prophet said. Okay? Yes, Adam, question.
I have two questions. Why does it say that animal here? Is that all human?
Yes.
And why does it say all?
It's a translation, can go either way. We're not sure which one. All will hear or whoever hears. But here's another reason. You bring up, remind me of something else. Another reason they never considered John could be this voice, I mean, after all, he's physical, he's a human, and this voice is just this voice, is that it seems to be speaking to them about after a victory, after there is a deliverance, after the kingdom has been set up. It almost seems to be something that happens after the king is established. But here's John speaking before the kingdom is established. They really missed this one. They didn't do a very good job of getting this one straight, did they? And again, my contention is we don't tend to get things very straight either. And people I have found who, instead of looking at all the word as being God's speech to us, but they focus on end time events, I find consistently, and I'm sure there are exceptions, but I find almost consistently that it becomes a distraction from truth. I find lives don't tend to be real mature. I don't find their marriages to be strong. I don't find their families to be united and holy. I don't find them really being great representatives all the time of God's kingdom. Because they've taken and ripped out the scriptures, they've amputated things that have to do with the future, and they study that. And God doesn't say that the spirit of that is the testimony of Yeshua. He says the testimony of Yeshua is the spirit of this, the entire prophetic word of God. And it's all God's prophecy. It's all God speaking forth. Let's just be careful we don't get distracted. Now, I need to put a qualifier in here. You think, well, Grant's teaching we shouldn't study Daniel and Revelation and think about end time events. I'm saying no such thing. It's all God's word. So study Daniel, study Revelation. In fact, Revelation is one of the books that promises a blessing to whoever hears it read. And there's great blessing there. I'm glad it doesn't say blessing anyone who understands it, because nobody does. But if you hear it read, it stirs something in your spirit. It feeds your spirit in a way that may bypass your mind. And so by all means, read, study. I would never discourage you from that. But don't just focus on what's around the corner prophetically. I tell you what, these programs, I think there's some called like prophecy in the news. Think about this for a second. Whoever does this program or these kinds of programs, that means to keep the program going, every day they have to get the newspaper out and then the Bible and try to say, oh, where does that line up? Because if they can't find something that lines up that day, they don't have a show. One of the things the rabbis warn us about is you never get out the newspaper and the Bible and try to make them fit. Here's this Hebrew logic you need to have. You ready? There is a whole series of events that must take place before the Messiah returns. All right? That's one truth. It's unarguable. It's absolutely true. It's in stone. There's a whole series of things that must happen before the Messiah returns. Here's the other block you must hold on to. He could come back today, and you should expect him at any moment. How can these two things be true? And the rabbis say, God may make all these things happen. We'll see it, we'll recognize it, and Messiah will come. Or Messiah may come today, and when he does, he'll reveal how every one of those things did happen. We just didn't see it. And then we'll look at the prophetic record and say, oh my goodness, he had it perfectly right, and I was just blind to it. But see, if you're looking for the Antichrist, and you're looking for the temple to be rebuilt, and you're looking for a rapture, and all these things, you're not looking for him. And he's the one we're supposed to be looking for. All right? So don't get distracted by the other things. Robin, your hand is up. Oh, this is a great question. What is the great and terrible day of the Lord? Well, there are two things, prophetically, they're called the day of the Lord. There's this dark period of time called the tribulation, which would seem to be pretty emphatically 7 years in duration. The great tribulation is the last half of that period. That's called the day of the Lord. And then the kingdom of Messiah is also called the day of the Lord. They're not called each a day of the Lord, but they're both together called the day of the Lord. You can only have one the day of the Lord. So how can it be this dark time and then this wonderful time of light and glory and knowledge? Well, what is a day in Hebraic thought? It's not a period of 24 hours. It's a cycle of dark followed by light. This is why the Hebrew day begins at sundown. It goes from sundown to sundown. This is why we welcome in the Shabbat on Friday evening. The sun goes down, we light the candles, we welcome the Sabbath. Evening, morning, day one. Evening, the morning, day two. Dark, light, that's a cycle. That cycle can be 24 hours, it could be any period of time. It's not the length of time that makes a day. A yom, a day, is a cycle. So, the day of the Lord has 7 years of terrible darkness, followed by what looks like to be 1,000 years of light. That cycle of dark and light is the day of the Lord. Okay? All right? Yes, Charlotte.
The people who came to John and
Good point, Charlotte. They saw the the question is, did they see the Messiah and the prophet as being the same person? No, they saw them as two different people. That's why they asked him. You know, first of all, it says, not the Messiah. But they still thought, well, maybe he's the prophet. Well, what was to make them think they weren't two different people? Now we know that they're the same person. Now, here, let's make it a little more complicated. I know somebody's going to be asking this question next. They asked John, are you Elijah? He says emphatically, no. And then, what does Yeshua say? In Matthew 11:13-15, here's what Messiah says. For all the prophets and the Torah prophesied until John. If you are willing to accept it, he is Elijah who is to come. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. John says, I'm not Elijah. Yeshua says, he kind of is. And then in Matthew 17, the apostles are still a little curious about John the Baptist. He just didn't quite fit any pictures. Look what he says in Matthew 17, verses 10. The disciples asked him, then why... Oh, we need to move it up, don't we? There we go. Excuse me while I put some spit on here so it doesn't slide off. There we go. All right. There we go. I'm sorry. I know that's really gross. I'll warn you next time before I do that so you won't be grossed out. Is that working now? Okay. And the disciples asked him, then why do the scribes say... Now, the scribes were the teachers of Torah, the Levites, the scribes. These are the ones who were responsible for communicating God's word. People didn't own Torah scrolls back then. So they went and the scribes proclaim it and teach it. Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? Because we know you're the Messiah, they're saying, but according to the scriptures, Elijah has to come first, but here you are. We missed Elijah somewhere along the road. So Yeshua answers, this is what he says, Elijah must come, and he will restore all things. So Yeshua says, Elijah will come, he'll restore all things, but I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him. Yeshua says, Elijah must come, and he's already come, they didn't recognize him. Now who saw that one coming? Who in the world studying the Hebrew Scriptures could ever foresee how God will fulfill the prophecy about Elijah's coming? He came, nobody recognized him. John himself didn't recognize it. But he came in the spirit and power of Elijah, but yet Elijah will come. He still will return in the future. It says, but did to him whatever they please, so also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. In other words, what they do to the forerunner, they do to the Messiah. You kill the forerunner, that's what you're going to do to the Messiah, because our message is the same. You embrace and accept the forerunner's message, you embrace and accept the Messiah. So the moment, if you study the Gospels, you'll notice that Yeshua's message, his approach to the people, the moment John the Baptist is executed, Yeshua's message goes through a change. And his approach to people goes through a subtle change, because now Yeshua knows which branch in the road is ahead for him. It's a very subtle thing, but when you look for it, you'll see it. It is clear once you look for it. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Immerser. How does this work? Here's one of the things that I think where a lot of so-called end-time scholars get it wrong. Revelation is probably the most spiritual book, the most spiritual book in the Greek scriptures. By spiritual, I mean by being so non-physical. It is describing things in the hidden realm. And the only way to talk about things in the spiritual realm is through symbolism, by talking about things in the physical realm. But we can get so distracted by the symbolism that we miss what is really being taught. You know, one of the things that really put the brakes on for me as far as my believing I really understood Bible prophecy and Revelation and Daniel is when I began to read the ancient Jewish writings, the ancient mystical writings, And they're all written in the same kind of verbiage and symbolism as the book of Revelation. And I mean to tell you, when you begin to immerse yourself in that, you come back to Revelation and think, I don't understand a thing. And then finally God says, now you're starting to understand. Revelation's a spiritual book. Everything about Revelation is to reveal Messiah to us in some way. And yet, we tend to make the same mistake these men made. They looked for a physical Elijah, and there is a physical Elijah coming. Yeshua confirms that. But they completely miss that God can do things in a spiritual way, and usually does do them in a spiritual way first. Let me put this, and we'll go to Jim's question. You see, you must not forget that there is the world at large, but each one of you is a world as well. This is why the Talmud says, whoever saves a man's life, whoever saves a soul, has saved a whole world. Because each one of you is as complex as this entire world is by itself. This is why when people argue with me, well, Yeshua couldn't be in the Messiah because he brings world peace when he comes. And I say to them, don't you read your own writings? You are an entire world. So am I. And I tell you what, he brought peace to this world, and he brought it in spades. This is a world that did accept him eventually. And there were some serious birth pains I went through. But there was a rebirth, a birth from above. And I tell you what, this is where the king rules. And here, there is peace. I'm not a spiritual carnivore anymore. The lion and the lamb now dwell in peace in this person. Once in a while, I really goof up. But that's what he's doing. He's coming into invisible worlds everywhere. So if Messiah could come into the world of your life and your life and your life, that means there had to be a forerunner in your life and your life and your life. Who is that forerunner? The spirit of Elijah. Make straight the way of the Lord. It's a voice in the wilderness. And every one of you who has given your life to the Lord, I guarantee you did it because there's a little voice there that says, you need to change. You need to make things smooth. You need to open the door. You need to prepare and allow God to come into your life. And in your dark hearts, that voice, that spirit of Elijah, is calling. Make straight the way of the Lord. Prepare a path for the Lord. Allow him to come in. You follow? So as Messiah invades and sets up his kingdom in each of the little worlds here, his Elijah came as well, preparing the way for him to come into the world that is you. You understand? Now, he works from the inside out. So when he comes into the whole world, he'll send Elijah first, and then Messiah will come, and every eye will see him, every eye will behold him. But right now, he's working incognito. He's working invisibly. Even when Messiah was on earth, most of his work was very invisible. And when he did do something, he said, shh, don't tell anybody. Of course, they always did. Okay, Jim, your hand is up. Yeah, and I believe that there is a millennium, 1,000 years long. It's that it's the 7 years of darkness followed by the 1,000 years, and that makes the day of the Lord. Then after that, new heavens and new earth. But then again, that's what I think. That's what I see. But now I doubt my own infallibility a whole lot. And so it's probably a whole lot better even than that. So, and Adam, did I see your hand up?
Yeah.
Does each person have to experience the wilderness before they experience Messiah? Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, why would you ever invite him in? Now I know children can... let me put it this way. You have to go back to the wilderness period, the 40 years between Egypt and the Promised Land. For some people, that 40 years was a time of great love for God, devotion to him, intimacy with him. For others, it was just a time of death. They all went through it, but their experiences were different. And so I think for each of us, that our experience of that wilderness time can be very different. But the wilderness represents that time of putting off the old, putting on the new, and growing up. And we all have to go through that. Yeah. Okay, let's go. Yes, Steve. Well, why weren't people so impressed with John? Why'd they come to him? I think there had to be that spiritual draw. There had to be a spiritual connection there. But also, people were getting very fed up with the religious system of the day. They're getting very fed up with it, but it was the only game in town until John comes along. And then when the Pharisees come to check him out, he really chews them out. And anyways, you can read all about that in Matthew 3 and 4. So it's Matthew 3. Yes? Oh, yeah. There are all kinds of people going to him. They knew something was happening. Something was about to happen. And it's you can only use your imaginations to try to go back there and picture what that was. But Yeshua praises John as being one of the greatest ever born of women. I mean, we can't even begin. There's so little written about him that I don't think we can hardly begin to imagine what a spectacular personality he was, what a grand soul he was. And to meet him would meant to be changed. You were changed. Unless you have a hard heart like a Pharisee, some of the Pharisees, then you weren't. So it's a great question, is one I have. I'm just speculating. But he had to have been such a grand soul, amazing soul. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on. Bernie, we got to move on, buddy. I'm sorry. So we're just going to keep on moving. Keep on moving on. So I have one more slide here. I want us to go back to John chapter 1 again. Again, just to express to you how bad our track record is. So in John 1, we have these people come to John the Baptist. They have three options. Two of those options tend to be the same option. They still blew it. And then the option John gave them was one they never even foresaw coming. And then where does Messiah come from? I want you to look at the confusion over this one. And let's see. And let's go to John chapter 1. And verse 45. John chapter 1, 45. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the Torah and also the prophets wrote, Yeshua of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." So in other words, we found the Messiah. His name is Yeshua. He's from Nazareth. He's the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" In other words, Messiah doesn't come from Nazareth. And everybody knew Messiah comes from Bethlehem. Because after all, if you read the prophecy, Micah 5:2, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephratah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days." Very clearly stated. In fact, when Herod and the wise men came and they were looking for the Messiah, Herod consulted the Torah scholars and they said, "Where is he to be born?" They said, "Well, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem." And they were exactly right. They got it. But the thing is, in Yeshua's time, when he was here, everybody thought of him as being from Nazareth. Now, get the timeline. When he's born in Bethlehem, right? Shortly thereafter, within the next year or two, God sends an angel to warn Joseph, "Flee to Egypt. I'll tell you when to come back." So they go to Egypt, years pass, maybe 10 years or so. And all this time, Yeshua is completely out of Israel. So are Joseph, so are Mary, and finally, The news is given to them, Herod's dead. The one who wants to destroy your son, he's dead. So they come back, but they don't come back to Bethlehem. They go up to Nazareth. And then he just grows up there. So now he's 30 years old. How many people remembered that birth in Bethlehem 30 years earlier? A few of the shepherds, a few of the people in Bethlehem, probably some of them had probably died off by then. So as far as everyone's concerned, this Yeshua, he's from Nazareth. It's almost as if God took strides and took pains to hide Yeshua's birth from the people who lived at that time. Think about that. God could very easily have made it abundantly clear to everyone, Messiah, Yeshua, was born in Bethlehem. This man, who everybody's talking about being the Messiah, he was born in Bethlehem. But God hid that from the people of the day, from most everyone. They didn't know that. Why would God want to hide something like that? But I contend there are a lot of things God is hiding because of his own wisdom, his own purposes. And when we start getting very proud and confident that we understand exactly how things are going to pan out, we're going to be embarrassed when they don't come out just the way we think God should make them come out. There are things God hides from us. You know, the revealed things belong, the hidden things belong to God, but the revealed things belong to us and our children forever, Deuteronomy says. So there are some hidden things here. So you come here, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And then, of course, you know the story. Nathanael saw him, and Yeshua kind of jerked his chain, so to speak. And then Nathanael really changed his tune. But now I want to look at a prophecy. Look at Matthew 2:23. And he, Yeshua, went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. Quote, he shall be called a Nazarene, unquote. Anybody know where that prophecy is? Anybody know where that prophecy is? He shall be called a Nazarene. Where? No, not in the Talmud. It's nowhere. It's nowhere. Absolutely nowhere in the Bible. Nowhere. So how in the world could Matthew, who was a bright guy, say that this took place so that what the prophets prophesied might be fulfilled, that his name would be called a Nazarene? Now, your translations probably put that last phrase in quotes. It shouldn't be. But where in the world is it prophesied he should be called a Nazarene? Well, this is where it's derived, and we go make full circle all the way back to Isaiah 11, verse 1. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. The word for branch, I'll put this over here so it won't slide. That word for branch is the word netzer. It's the root of the word Nazareth. That's the only hint. So God orchestrated that Yeshua should live in Nazareth and be called a Nazarite because he's a fulfillment of the fact that he is the Netzer. Vayatsa choter megeza Yeshai, and there shall go forth a shoot from the stump of Yeshai, or Jesse. Vanetzer, and a branch, mashroshoiv Yifra, from his roots shall be fruitful. There it is. That's what Matthew's referring to. A play on words, but still a very important one. And I ask you, how many plays upon words, how many subtle hidden prophecies are in the word that no one sees? And all the end time experts don't see it all because God has hidden them to reveal to us later. And so people, during that first century, were very confused. And there are a number of scriptures we could look at where they express their confusion about who Yeshua is. For example, John 7:40-43, on hearing his words, Yeshua's words, some people in the crowd said, "Surely this man is the prophet." Others said, "This is the Messiah." But others said, "How can the Messiah come from Galilee? Doesn't the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, say the Messiah is from the seed of David? He comes from Bethlehem, the village where David lived?" You see the controversy? We understand it better today than they did then. And that is always the way it is with end times events. You'll understand it when it's done. Don't expect to understand it very well beforehand. But there's a lot of money to be made on end time events, an awful lot of money. Lots and lots and lots of money. Because you see, people are more interested in knowing what's in the future, wanting to know what's in the future, what's around the corner, instead of wanting to know who made the corner, who holds the future. Our energy should be focused on knowing the who more than the what. Because the whole world wants to know the what. But God's children really, truly want to know the who. And our entire focus should be on the one who is the spirit of prophecy, the testimony of Yeshua himself, the very communication of God, the word of God to us, who is our Messiah. Rashi, who's considered to be the greatest commentator on the Torah of all time, he lived back in the 1100s, I believe. He lived in France and was a towering genius of Torah. He comments on a verse in Deuteronomy 18, verse 13, which says, well, I'll read 13 and 14. Deuteronomy 18:13-14 says, "You shall be blameless before Adonai your God. For these nations which you are about to dispossess, they listen to fortune tellers and to diviners. But as for you, Adonai your God has not allowed you to do this." And what Rashi talks about here, and what is so true today, is as believers, we put aside the astrology, we put aside tarot cards and crystal balls and tea leaves trying to go to see people who can foresee the future. We don't do that. We know that's a cult and that's wrong. We don't do it. But you know what we substitute in its place? We take the scriptures and try to make it our crystal ball. Instead of making it our bread of life, we want to make it our crystal ball to get some kind of esoteric knowledge about what's around the corner. Now, there's some esoteric knowledge revealed to us. But it's part of a larger body of truth. Let's take it all in together. And let's make sure our goal is always to know God better. But when we use it only to try to figure out end-time events, we're basically doing the thing that God warns us not to do. And this is what Rashi says: "Walk with him simple-heartedly and look forward to what he has in store. Do not probe the future, but rather accept whatever happens to you simple-heartedly." Again, don't take what I'm saying to an extreme. I believe that when the end time events really start happening upon us and Israel's return as a nation, return to their land as a nation, most obviously, most definitely is a massive fulfillment of prophecy. No question about that one. Since then, not a whole lot. Not a whole lot's happened. Maybe some things have, we just don't see. But I know there's a lot of things people are seeing that just aren't happening. So, let's live our lives. Let's choose life. Let's live lives expectantly every day for Messiah to come. And I think that should God ordain that we go through the tribulation, should he ordain, "Oh, you're a pre-millennial tribulationist, anti-rapture." Don't put labels on me. I don't know what's going to happen. But should God bring us through difficult times that are the things spoken of in Revelation, at that time, I expect he'll open our hearts to see and understand exactly what's going on. In the meantime, let's keep our eyes on him, on Yeshua. Let's not focus and dread the birth pains. Let's look at the new world that those birth pains are going to bring into existence. That's where we should be focused. It says of Messiah that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. I think too many of us read it and say, for all the pain set before us, we're going to write a lot of books and make ourselves famous and make money and impress our friends. Okay? Let's be careful we just avoid that. Let's let God speak for himself, and we'll try to understand it the best we can. But let's just humble ourselves and admit we don't get it very well. These people back here in the first century certainly didn't get it very well. They got some things right, but they missed an awful lot. I don't think our track record is going to be much better. I just really don't think so. All right? Mike, we're going to give you the final word.
I just have two things.
Sure, go ahead.
Rachel was very, very deaf and deaf to God.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that's in relation to where Jesus was
born. Oh, yes, right.
Mm-hmm. But what the designation of the whole land of Israel, is it from the Euphrates?
Yeah, well, you're getting a... Yeah. Well, there's no question that eventually it will expand on out. God prophesied that the borders of Israel would expand out. But that's going to be in the future yet. So right now, up to the Euphrates is not part of the border of Israel, but someday, prophetically, it will be. Yeah. But there's a spiritual lesson there for us, but I'll leave you all to figure that out over Oneg. All right? So let's close in prayer, and I'll invite Ben to come up and do the blessing. Our Father, our King, we thank you so much that you're such a good Father, but we're such children of our understanding. And Father, I pray we would not commit the sin of ignoring the end time events that you would reveal to us in your word. But I pray we would not either commit the sin of taking those things and amputating them out of the word to make them something different and using it to build a name for ourselves or to frighten people or to sensationalize. But Father, maybe just have a healthy and a wholesome approach to your word, looking for Yeshua in every verse, looking for what you would say to us about yourself in every word. For Lord, we know that the testimony of Yeshua is the spirit of prophecy. So, Lord, help us never to forget that. And, Lord, I pray you would help us not do what John did and to throw himself down at the feet of one who's revealing the future to him instead of throwing himself down at the feet of you. So, Lord, help us to become the people you want us to be. Make us that, Father. Whatever that looks like and whatever it costs, make us those people. And we'll give you the praise for it in Yeshua's name. Amen.